Mo Willems is kind of a big deal in the world of children's literature. His books are like Saturday Night Live for kids with recurring characters, a wry elephant, an extroverted pig, and a snake who struggles with armlessness. They act out comedic sketches about sharing and making new friends, stuff like that. The books are a hit, and there's an exhibit of the most popular Mo Willems characters on display now in Topeka. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we're talking to Mo Willems today about his life, his characters, his stories, and why kids love them. Hi, Mo. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gina. It's good to be here.
So how do you feel about my comparing your children's books to Saturday Night Live?
I think that the sketch comparison is actually a pretty good comparison. I came from comedy. I came from sketch comedy. And I see my books often formatted in terms of structurally as sketch. I also like that my drawings are sketchy.
Let's get specific. Can we talk? Well, I first of all want to say you also have worked on Sesame Street, and I think Sesame Street also is essentially sketch comedy.
Yeah, Sesame Street was a sketch comedy show. And certainly I learned a lot about writing, just writing a good sketch, making it tight. And I also learned about writing for children there. So for me, that was like graduate school with Muppets.
But the thing about the difference between Sesame Street and your books, humor-wise, is that I think with Sesame Street, adults and kids tend to be laughing for different reasons. And with your books, I'm like 99% sure that my 2-year-old and I are laughing for exactly the same reason, which seems like a hard thing to pull off.
That's very flattering. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, television is different. There are a lot of people writing it. And the idea of writing on two levels was something that was kind of the Sesame ethos at the time. For me, I do prefer to write on one level, and that is the human being level. You know, I think that kids are, the difference between adults and kids is that they're smaller, not that they're dumber. They're just new. So I try to treat all of my audience with the same respect.
Can we talk about Elephant and Piggy?
Sure. I mean, I'm here. We might as well.
So these are two of your recurring characters. They have a series together. And There Is a Bird on Your Head is kind of a favorite within that series. So these are all frame by frame sequential art stories, sequential art being sort of like comic book style.
Yeah, they're comics. Yeah, I mean, sequential art is fancy for saying comics. You can say comics. We're all friends here.
It's not that I have something against comics, but I think it's not quite what people would picture when they picture a comic, because you don't see multiple frames on one page. Every page is a frame.
That's correct. Right. Yeah, there are no panels. I don't draw panels.
But so you are, though, tracking action like you would in a movie from one image to the next, and the words are only in dialogue bubbles, so it's just image and dialogue. Can you talk to me about that technique?
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, easy readers, as they're called, are also hard writers. I mean, they're the hardest type of book to write because it has to be entertaining, it has to be funny, but there's a very limited vocabulary. When I was making those books, I limited them to about 40 distinct words, maybe 50 distinct words in each adventure. And as a kid is starting to decode language, I wanted to give the actual language the same heft, the same percentage as the illustration. So I basically cut the page in half, and the top page of the half is the words, but they're also illustrations. You know, the words get bigger when you yell, or they get smaller when you whisper. The bubble shapes change and they sort of help you. And then the bottom half of the page is the illustration, which should sort of help you get a sense of what the emotion of that character is going through. So I really just sort of cut the page in half and allowed that dialogue of image and text to work together.
So There Is a Bird on Your Head is one that I just referenced. Can you kind of summarize that plot and explain how it shows the two characters, the distinctive characters of Gerald, or Elephant, and Piggy, his best friend?
Elephant Gerald. Elephant Gerald sees the glass as half full of yuck. he's a pessimistic character, while Piggy is just happy that there's a glass. And in There's a Bird on My Head, not to give away any spoilers, there's a bird on the head of Gerald. And Gerald is very freaked out, frankly. Gerald is a nervous elephant and is trying to figure out what to do about this bird on the head. And Piggy is at first reporting what is happening because he can't see what's on top of his head, and then giving some advice on how to deal with the crisis of having a bird on your head, ultimately having several birds on your head who fall in love and have little birds.
And Piggy is very, like, moved by the family story that's developing on her friend's head.
That's right. The narrative on Gerald's head is adorable. I mean, it's two birds that fall in love. They end up having chicks. So Piggy does get involved in the birdie narrative of this, perhaps ignoring Gerald's panic of having now to sort of house a bird environment on his head.
So as someone who has read this book many, many times to a very little person, as that person is developing not just language, but emotional intelligence, the thing that I find sort of brilliant about this is that if your child is so young that they don't know what a facial expression necessarily means yet, and you're kind of helping them understand it as you read the book, you're sort of illustrating with these two characters, okay, you know, elephant, look at elephant's face. Elephant looks really frustrated. And then look at Piggy's face. Doesn't Piggy look happy? And you're teaching emotional intelligence.
I think you are, because you're the one reading it. I mean, the person in the room is doing the magic. I'm only putting in 49% of the book. But you're right, I am playing a lot with emotions. And one of the fun things in the Elephant and Piggy books is to have two characters say the exact same sentence with totally diametrically opposing rationales and meanings. Like, to me, that's funny. So if you look at the illustrations, by and large, Elephant and Piggy, if they're on the page together, will be having opposing emotional states. Every now and then, their emotions will be the same. But by and large, it's Gerald is sad, Piggy is happy. Gerald becomes happy, Piggy is sad or frustrated. And the big moments of drama are when they share their emotional valences at the same time. Those are kind of the big funny beats.
So what about another series with the starring character of Pigeon? Who is Pigeon?
Oh, that that will involve many hours of therapy. I don't think that we can do that within
the
confines of this.
Who is Pigeon, really?
The Pigeon is a character that is unique to all of my characters for me, because all of my other characters I developed, much like you would develop a TV show. I spend many years with them. I draw them. I doodle them. I try and figure out who they are. I get a lot of backstory for myself. And the Pigeon literally just appeared on one of my sketchbooks one day, fully formed, complaining about my other work.
Yeah, I love that this is a character who argues with his own author and his own illustrator about what is happening.
Well, he's very frustrated. I mean, he hates it when I make books that are not about him. And that's one of the reasons why he sneaks into all of my other books. He's a stinker. He's a terrible, terrible bird to have to live with.
How did you get into telling stories for kids? I know you have this background in Sesame Street and a background in comedy, but is working for an audience of children something that you always wanted to do, or did that just happen?
No, I think everybody, when they're starting out as a young writer, you know, they want to speak, they want to be the voice of a generation, and they want that generation to be theirs. So when I was hired by Sesame Street, I was doing grown-up comedy, and they hired grown-up comedians because they figured, well, it's hard to teach you how to be funny, but we can teach you how to write for kids.
That makes total sense to me.
So in the beginning, I was just happy to have a gig. I mean, quite frankly, I was just like, well, I'm writing sketch comedy. I had a comedy group that had sort of splintered off and become a group called The State. They had a show on MTV. I was very, very jealous. But here I was finally writing sketch. And what happened over the course of a couple seasons is I started to realize that writing for kids was harder, because there are no cultural modifiers. I couldn't reference anything. If I said Arc de Triomphe, that meant nothing. So I was sort of stuck with these core emotional issues, jealousy, joy, anger, frustration, confusion, wanting to drive a bus.
That is a major human emotion.
Absolutely. Actually, and then it started to become sort of fundamental Greek philosophical questions. And for myself, this was just a wonderful revelation because I'm a misanthrope. I don't really like following popular culture or knowing what's going on. So now I don't have to write comedy about the latest musician or the latest movie, or I don't have to spoof anything. I can just go to this well of existential crisis, of neuroses, of all of these things that make life confusing and wonderful at the same time.
I want to get back into all of that, but there is a book of yours that I've read that is dedicated to your mom, Nanette's Baguette, where a kid goes on an errand to get a baguette. It's her biggest...
No, it's not dedicated to... It's dedicated to moms.
Oh.
Philosophically.
Philosophically.
Much larger,
There was someone, I thought, in the dedication with the last name Willems, but...
That would have been Cher Willems, which would be my wife.
Oh, a mom also.
Yes. A mom.
I'm curious, though, about when you are writing for kids, do you have to kind of go back to your own kid self and the characters who populated your kid life, or do you not do that?
I think that most children's authors are ex-children.
Right.
We all seem to have started out in childhood. And so there is something of remembering what it feels like. I'm not sure that I'm actually, for myself, taking episodes from my childhood. I am empathetic to childhood. I am of the opinion that even a good childhood is difficult. It is hard to be a child. The furniture is not made to your scale. You have zero agency over the world. You don't have much control. You can't choose your sippy cup. If you're having fun, you can be told to stop because the time is over. You can be physically lifted into another room. All of these are great injustices. You know, if I were sitting here talking to you and this giant hand came into the studio and took me to another room, I would start making annoyed sounds. And then if I got criticized for being fussy, for being angry that this hand was lifting me out of the room, it would sort of spiral into, you know, great confusion. So I have great sympathy for the state of childhood. It's a difficult, difficult time where, again, if you want to sit down, you have to climb up first.
You know, when you were talking about your time at Sesame Street, I'm curious about what some of the other insights. I mean, you talked about the insight that you can't reference pop culture or you can't reference really anything too specific that a person would have to have learned about. What are some of the other insights you got there into what kids find funny and authentic, I think, is a big thing.
I think authentic is more important. Like, I mean, you'll never know what's funny. It's impossible to ever know what's funny. And so the key to writing funny is to just always write. And your muscles, like an athlete's muscles, when they practice, they get stronger and stronger and stronger. And what you do is you're able to feel what isn't funny. And then you take out all the not funny and you hope for the best.
I heard a saying once. I don't know if this is a real saying, but someone told me you should never give a gift you wouldn't want to receive. And I think that that's kind of what you're saying about comedy, is that you should never make a joke assuming that your audience is going to find it funny, even if your audience is kids, if you don't.
Yes. I mean, you know, my mantra is that I always think of my audience, but I never think for my audience. And so that involves a certain willingness to land on your face. And one of the reasons that I love books is because, unlike television, which involves a lot of people and a lot of money, in a book is relatively easy to make. So you can experiment and do something completely crazy. And if people don't like it, well, you know, it's not that big a deal. You move on and you make another book.
Do you have an all-time favorite Sesame Street sketch? I do call them sketches, by the way.
Yes, sketch, yeah. Totally in contrast to everything we've been talking about in terms of cultural modifiers, I wrote a bit that I loved because it was such a dumb bit and it was so specific and I went so far to get to this joke, but I took great pleasure in it. It played in ancient Rome, so already we're in a weird place. So Caesar is now the emperor of Rome, and he is throwing a giant triangle party. And all of the senators need to bring their favorite triangles and show off how great their triangles are. And Brutus shows up, and he doesn't have a triangle. He has a giant number two. So that Caesar then says, "A two, Brutus?
Oh.
That's not a triangle. That's a two, Brutus."
So, but that is a perfect example of the kind of humor that adults are laughing at for one reason and kids for another, because all the kid needs to know
is it's not a triangle.
Right. And that, like, Caesar's maybe kind of in charge.
Yeah. And they're all wearing, sheets. that's Sesame. That's writing on two levels.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking to children's book author and illustrator Mo Willems. He's the creator of the Pigeon series, Pigeon Has to Go to School, Pigeon Needs a Bath, and the Elephant and Piggy books. If you have a question for Mo Willems or a story about how his books have been part of your life, call 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with Mo Willems. He's a children's book author and illustrator, also an animator. He's coming from a background in comedy, in Sesame Street, and he has an exhibit right now, The Pigeon Comes to Topeka. It's on display at the Kansas Children's Discovery Center in Topeka through January 4th. And Mo, tell me more about that exhibit. It's character-driven, right?
Yes, this is a children's museum exhibit, so everything is physical. You can play with it. There are games. You draw. There's a hot dog tosser. There's a lot of animation stuff, learning how to make drawings, learning how persistence of vision works. It's something that I worked with a museum in Pittsburgh for several years on, and it's just been a joy because it is interactive, and I make sure that all the characters that I create are designed so that they're simple enough for a five-year-old to draw them reasonably. I really want my work not just to be read, but to be played. And in order to get kids to draw, grown-ups have to draw as well. I mean, because parents forget that they're cool. But if a parent sits there and doodles, a kid will. And so everything in this exhibit is really made to get both the kids and the grown-ups in the kids' life, sort of get them together, playing together, drawing and creating together. So
why is it important to you that kids draw?
Oh, drawing is essential. Drawing is a form of physicalized empathy. When you make a drawing, no matter who the character is, a villain or a good guy or a plant or a rock, you're thinking about that character. You're empathizing with that character. It is a great way to work through your life to figure out thoughts. We put on our dining room table, my family, most evenings, and every time we have guests, a giant roll of butcher block paper, and everybody draws. And when my kid was younger, we'd talk about things, and you would see him come out in the drawings. Or my father-in-law, who's coming in 2 days, he was a businessman, really was not interested in pulling out a crayon. And for the first couple of years, he just made spreadsheets. And then those spreadsheets morphed into these beautiful abstractions and all this different sense of color. And he goes to museums now and takes pictures to think about, well, when I come to dinner, I want to explore this palette or this shape or this idea. We're here to empathize with others. We're here to discover ourselves, and the most practical way to do it, the first way humans ever did it, is through drawing.
So when you mentioned your daughter and that you have a family, how you started out as this guy who was into comedy, and having a kid changes everything no matter what you do, but I would think the change would be especially evident for a children's book author.
I don't think it's necessary to have a kid to write books for children. But you're right. Having a child changes absolutely everything about how you see the world, your relationship with the world, your relationship with others, your sense of the future, of your own mortality, of your weaknesses, of others' strengths. So, of course, it's going to come out in your work. And if every now and then you have a kid who does something hilarious that you can steal and use for profit, well, you know, that's cool too.
When you, is there an example of a time when that happened?
Well, I mean, I Knuffle Bunny, there's three of those books, you know, that's everything is fictionalized. Everything in my books, specifically the Knuffle Bunny books, is true, except for the things that I made up. But I, you know, I still profited off of the misadventures of my child, sure.
Can you give a specific misadventure that?
Well, literally the bunny lost in the laundry. I mean, that's a starting point for an existential crisis.
That happened in your home.
Again, everything that is true except for the parts I made up. It's like being somewhat of a certain age. You have to keep your secrets.
Well, let's talk to Kendon. Kendon is calling us at 816-235-2888. Hi, Kendon.
Hi there.
Speaking
of, so you guys have already transitioned to Knuffle Bunny, which is what I was calling about.
Oh, that's great. Hi, how are you, Kendon?
I'm very well, man. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mo. You're something of a legend in our home, and I just wanted to share how impactful the Knuffle Bunny series has been, specifically on our household. We've got three daughters, and it's become something of a tradition now that each of our daughters, when they enter our family, acquired their own Snuggle Bunny, as we call it now.
Excellent.
And yeah. So my wife's an early childhood educator, and we have just absolutely fallen in love with your writing, and it became, you know, one of the three rotational books that you know got worn out and had to get a second copy when the first one was retired and held together with tape.
That's awesome. Well, thank your wife for what she does. You know, I'm always appreciative of all librarians and teachers and the day in and day out work that they do.
Kendon, can
Absolutely.
I ask you a question? Is there like a role that these books have had in these characters, especially Knuffle Bunny, in just your children's lives and their development and
yeah.
who they are?
Absolutely. Well, you know, and I think you guys may have been touching on it right as I was connecting, but, you know, specifically teaching how important it is to teach our kids empathy through these object lessons that are, you know, so simple in concept, but, you know, teach them how to empathize with what it means to experience loss. And then, you know, I think, as you said, an existential crisis of losing one's bunny. I can recall a specific story where my wife was at a department store with our second daughter, and her Snuggle Bunny went missing. And it was, you know, everyone stopped their lives to go look for this thing. We were posting on social media and calling in for reinforcements, and, you know, had half the staff at this department store searching frantically for this thing that didn't end up turning up at our house hours later.
Kendon, thank you so much for sharing that. And yeah, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Ken.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
You know, how do you, this is maybe not a how-to kind of question, but this, you were talking earlier about finding these sort of universal feelings and tapping into what you called the well of existential dread in writing for children. How do you kind of identify these universal types of situations as opposed to just an episode that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think I get what you're saying. I mean, look, the answer is twofold and frankly boring. I mean, one is I'm completely neurotic, so I have the advantage of many various neuroses. And the other is it's just work, you know. I want everything to look like it took 5 minutes to make. I want it to, like, the ink to feel fresh on the page. But ultimately, it is, you know, a lot of ideas of filling up notebooks with thoughts, coming back, letting them marinate, asking difficult questions of yourself and of your work. In the Knuffle Bunny books, there were two sort of rationales outside of what you would normally think. One is I wanted the characters to grow up, and I wanted the season, the series to end. That was very important to me, that these characters were not eternal, that they changed over time. And the other is that I really wanted to show that very small things, little life stories, tiny episodes are worth telling. Losing your bunny is worth telling. It's a real story. So if you're a kid and you feel like, well, I don't really have any stories, you know, I go to school, I haven't gone to the moon yet, I'm not a major league baseball player yet, I haven't won the Nobel Prize, I haven't really done anything. That's not actually the case. These tiny little moments are really valuable, and they're worth telling and sharing and thinking about.
You know, kids' books are fascinating and strange in many ways. And as a reader, I feel like I'm constantly in the process of learning what is different about children's literature and why some children's books work and some don't. Because that's very different in a lot of ways from why some grown-ups' books work and some don't. And the importance in children's books of rhythm and repetition are just huge. And it feels in some ways more like writing music. Have you had to kind of tap into musicality in a way that...
Yeah, I think certainly music is a metaphor I use a lot. Another is sculpture. You know, a picture book is a form of sculpture. It's the size of the book matters. The shape of the book gives you a sense of what it's going to be like. The feel of the paper. You have to physically turn the page to get to the next point of the story. So that page turn, that magic of how what you see as you turn the page and then your eye moves to the left and all of that stuff is extraordinarily important. And yes, the musicality is part of it. The rhythm, how many words are on a page, how I anticipate that the audience is going to read these words. Are they going to read them fast? Are they going to read them slow? Can I manipulate my orchestra, that is you, the reader, to help my audience understand what's going on? Can I get you to be silly? Can I make you yell? All of those things are questions, formal questions that I have to answer. The point of the matter is just for you not to notice that I'm doing that.
What about the running gag? Because I feel like there's a character named Snake who I feel has this running gag of things he can't do because he has no arms.
Right, right. I guess it is a running gag. I mean, the Snake character came in one of the Elephant and Piggy books. And there was a real rationale for what I was trying to do with that story, that the idea that you can play with, interact with characters who are substantially different from you. And so this is not just a question of disability. This is a question of just being very, very different. There's always a way that you can find some connection. And I suppose after getting to meet Snake and getting to know Snake during the production of this book, I just kind of liked him, so I thought maybe I could cast him in a couple more things.
Well, let's take one more call. We've got Kathleen with us in Lansing, Kansas. Hi, Kathleen.
Well, I'm so glad to be on with you. I want to say that the pigeon lives at my house. He's a 2-year-old boy. when his mother, my daughter, was young, she and I both loved the pigeon. Don't let the pigeon drive the bus. And so now in the form of this young 2-year-old boy who wants to do everything no one in their right mind would let a 2-year-old do. And he's very loud and vocal about it. And we look at one another often and say, don't let the pigeon drive the bus. And we think we're so amusing.
That's excellent.
Thank you for that.
Well, thank you for reading
Kathleen.
The books. You know, they don't work if you don't read them. You are the ones who are making them work. So thank you, Kathleen.
Well, Mo, before we have to go, because we're on public radio, I do want to address a little known item on your resume. You were a radio cartoonist for NPR for a while. It's patently absurd. Can you talk about that experience?
I think a lot of my career has been realizing that really good ideas are hard to come by, but really, really bad ideas are easier to come by.
Agreed.
So, So the idea of becoming a radio cartoonist, I'd done a couple of things with Michelle Norris, and we got on. And so I just said, like, wouldn't it be cool if I were the radio cartoonist and I could describe the drawing and you guys could come up with the gags? And they were like, I don't know for sure. And I said, listen, on Sunday we could do it in full color. And eventually they bought into it. And we did it maybe for a month or so, but it was great. Look, the joy of my career is that I have all these different sandboxes that I've been allowed to play in. And it would be a shame not to play in every sandbox that I find.
Mo Willems, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Pigeon Comes to Topeka is on display at the Kansas Children's Discovery Center in Topeka through January 4th. You can find out more online. We will link to that info with this audio when we post the interview later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Up next, the story of a Kansas German dialect, why and how it changed. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. A University of Kansas professor has been tracking how German-speaking populations in Kansas and Missouri have been changing over the last 30-plus years. He's been going around documenting how people say German phrases. Common phrases like, "My dear child, stay down here. Those mean geese will bite you to death." Or, "Who stole my basket of meat?" And, "The good old man broke through the ice with his horse and fell into the cold water."
Der gute alte Mann brach durch die Eis mit seinem Pferd und fall in das kalte Wasser.
Der alte Mann ist durch das Eis gefallen mit seinem Gaul in das kalte Wasser.
Der gute alte Mann ist durchbrochen durch das Eis mit seinem Ross. Die sind ins kalte Wasser eingefallen.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and Professor William Keel is here now to unpack what this all means and tell us what happened to the German-speaking populations around here. Hi, William. Great to have you.
Hi, good morning.
Those sentences you had people read are very strange, but I assume there's a reason you had people talk about mean geese and baskets of meat?
Well, for better or for worse, back in the 1870s in Germany, they began a comprehensive documentation of German dialects or varieties that people would speak in the farmyard, on the marketplace, not at universities or in businesses, but we talk about dialects. And what you just heard were three very good examples of a Low German, a Middle German, and an Upper German dialect.
What is the difference?
Well, do you have a house with a roof on it?
I do.
The peak of the roof is the top. And where your gutter is, that would be the bottom, right? And that's lower. And if you look at the geography of Central Europe, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, the mountains are in Austria, Switzerland. The sea coast, the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, are in the extreme north. And where the land is low, the dialects are classified as Low German. Where the dialects are in the mountains, they're Upper German. And in the middle, guess what? They're Middle.
But how do you hear the difference between those?
Well, without analyzing those three sentences too greatly, the word for horse appears in each of them. In the first sentence, that was a lady from Bueller, Kansas, who speaks Mennonite Low German, and she said Piet. Okay, I'll just say Piet. The person in the middle was a Volga German and said Gaul. And the person at the end speaks a Bavarian dialect out in Ellis County. His ancestors came from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he said Ross.
So he had, those are not just a little different.
No, they're a lot different. If you took German in school, you might have learned Pferd, P-F-E-R-D. And that's closest to the Low German Pferd. But they don't say the P-F, they say a P. Do you say apple or apfel?
Right. So, but I'm curious, what accounts for specifically Kansan dialects of German?
Well, what accounts for the Kansas variety is that people came to Kansas in the 19th century and even to this day from various parts of the German-speaking world and brought their native local dialects with them. People from Russia, the Volga Germans or the Mennonites, brought their particular dialects with them and started them here in Kansas. We're still getting Mennonites from Chihuahua, Mexico, bringing their Low German into southwestern Kansas with the meatpacking industry out there.
Can you say more about that? Because I have heard about this before, but I think it is surprising the first time you hear it that there are German-speaking Mennonite immigrants in Kansas coming from Mexico.
Right. Without getting too much into the details, the massive out-migration from the Russian Empire started in the late 19th century. Some of them went to Kansas. They were the smart ones. Some went to Canada and had a rough time, especially during World War I. They moved to Chihuahua, Mexico in the 1920s, and then economic times got bad, as we all know, in south of the border, and they started looking for a better job opportunity and came northward with the thousands of Mexicans coming to our feedlots and slaughterhouses established in southwestern Kansas about 30, 40 years ago.
What are some of the really major waves of German immigration that account for these pockets of German-speaking population?
Well, in Kansas specifically, we had first the territorial period and the great struggle over slavery, free state, etc. And the free state adherents actively recruited Germans to settle in territorial Kansas because they believed that the Germans would vote against slavery. Now, you might say, how can a German immigrant vote? Well, you didn't have to be a U.S. citizen in Kansas Territory. The Kansas-Nebraska Act said you got to be 21, white, male, and swear that you're going to be a citizen. And if that German immigrant swore to be a citizen, that person could vote against slavery. And the people in territorial Kansas actually estimated about an eighth of the population were German-speaking and actively catered to their vote for the state constitutions that were voted on.
What are some of the linguistic particularities that evolved in this region of this country?
Well, I wouldn't say so much that they evolved here, but they flourished here for roughly 100 years.
Sounding very much as they would have in the countries of origin?
When I first went out to Ellis County and interviewed Volga Germans nearly 40 years ago, I was knocked off my shoes because they said things that I had never encountered in years of study or at the university. I was in Ellis, and they started using a word, Enker. Well, you got to look in the big dictionaries to find that. It goes back to Indo-European times, and it's still preserved.
What does it mean?
It means you all, two people.
It's
that
like
you're
y'all. Speaking.
Yeah, like y'all. But anyway, it's preserved in some rural Bavarian dialects, and it's also preserved. Well, I hate to talk about this too much because I know the people are passing from the scene. The older speakers are dying, and soon these languages will disappear with two big exceptions. The Old Order Amish that speak Pennsylvania Dutch, and some of the Mennonites that coming from Mexico that still speak Plautdeutsch.
So there are still communities, though, where Kansas German dialects are spoken.
Oh, yes, definitely. We have several Amish communities down near Garnett over. Probably most people know about Yoder, Kansas, near Hutchinson. Missouri has many more Amish settlements and a great variety of language in those settlements, and they are growing by leaps and bounds. We estimate the Amish population will double in about 30 years and become about roughly 500,000 in the United States, and that is one of the fastest growing populations. They have large families. They live on an isolated rural farm, no cars, no electricity, no telephone, and they keep their language going.
I mean, it almost sounds like, though, it's also fossilizing language by this sort of maybe the isolation that comes with not being as, like, digitally connected or something.
I would say the fossilization occurs in the communities where the language has ceased to be transmitted to the next generation, and it's only the older population that still speaks the dialects. That's true for most of our Volga Germans, the Low Germans up near Hanover, Kansas, etc.
So I guess to say that, to even talk about like the death of a Kansas German dialect would be a huge exaggeration, but you do talk about two major characters or things that really dramatically changed those dialects, and those are Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany and the Model T Ford. Can you help me out here? I'm not totally sure I follow.
Well, that's a contrast. Most people, I would say, and I think I'm safe in talking about my colleagues around the country, would attribute the loss of the majority, the death of the speakers, really, not the languages themselves don't die, but the speakers die. They attribute it to the anti-German hysteria around World War I. So that's the Kaiser Bill image.
You're on a very informal basis with the Kaiser.
Well, he's my namesake. Okay. I don't want to get into that right now. But anyway, what I came to see was that I would not be encountering hundreds, if not thousands, of people at the end of the 20th century, and even in the first decades of the 21st century, that still can speak these languages very well if World War I had been so devastating. Why did they keep doing it? And why are they now the last generation? Well, if you look at some of the social aspects of the United States, Kansas, Missouri, the Model T is introduced in 1908. Our system of paved roads gets going in the 1920s and 30s. High school education becomes a major factor between the two wars. Prior to World War I, very few people completed high school. You went to your eighth grade, stayed on the farm. That was good. Now, at the end of the 20th century, people are driving everywhere. They're completing high school. Their socialization is in English, and they have no need for their immigrant German dialect anymore. The big exception are, of course, our friends, the Old Order Amish. No cars. Don't go to school past eighth grade. Stay on the farm and speak Deutsch.
Let's talk to John. He is calling us from Western Kansas, and he might have something to say about this. Hi, John.
Hi. Bin ich from Kansas City here. Na vielen Dank. Zoom, KCUR, and Public Radio, you are the best. Bin ich war ein kleiner Kind, ich habe lebens in Victoria, Kansas.
In Victoria, yeah.
Yeah, bin ich ein Herzogger. Where I'm from Victoria, Kansas, and the original name of the town was Herzog, but in 1913 they changed it to Victoria to be more English. Ich war die letzte, some of the letzte Kinder, das hat sich verstanden.
Wait, in 1913. Yeah. So that's a year before World War One.
That is correct, yes.
Interesting.
Because of the tensions growing, you know, they wanted to be Americans, recognized as Americans, you know. But the language carried on. One set of my grandparents would not speak to me until I was 12 years old, and I told them in German. My grandmother was saying, "Now, you know, be more responsible driver to my grandfather." And I was in the back seat. I said, "You know, I understood every word. Ich habe das verstanden, alles." I understood every word, so. They started speaking German to me, but it was just taboo because they were after World War II generation. Now, my other grandmother was a decade older,
wait, John,
and she spoke German all the time.
I want to jump in and ask you, you know, it sounds like you're fluent in this. How old are you?
I'm 44.
44. Mm-hmm. A 44-year-old who is fluent in a dialect of German spoken in Kansas. So you're talking about a generation of speakers dying. Are you talking about like this is their first language? Is that what you mean by a speaker, or is John kind? Yeah.
Yeah, John would be a pretty good exception to the rule if he's fluent in Herzog Deutsch. John, kannst du gut Deutsch? Oh, okay. It'd be interesting to find out if he has children, whether they have any ability to speak the language. What he said was interesting is that a lot of people said their parents spoke German. but then they didn't teach them to speak.
And it sounds like John was not intentionally taught.
It sounds like he was able to pick up some by listening to his grandparents and his parents. Yeah, but Victoria is beautiful, great community, and where the Cathedral of the Plains is located. If you drive by on Interstate 70, you can see it.
When you think about the story of what happened linguistically to this German-speaking community, does it tell us something that is worth keeping in mind as we think about other immigrant groups settling in Kansas and Missouri today?
Sure. The language is the heart and soul of the immigrant community. It's the glue that holds their whole culture together. And they may try to keep cuisine, special foods going. They may have festivals that they'll celebrate. But without that language, really the core of that culture is decimated. It's very hard to continue. And most people realize that. So it's a bittersweet kind of a situation.
What got you interested in the German-speaking populations of Kansas and Missouri?
Well, I've always been interested in the German-speaking populations. I grew up in St. Louis. Sorry, I have to mention that. but my maternal grandparents were German ancestry in near Jefferson City, and I got started by looking at books. Now, they did not speak German, but they had lots of old German books from my immigrant great-great-grandparents from Europe, and I would start trying to read them. And so now I'm still working on those people and their language.
Was this, I mean, you've mentioned your own ancestry, but how personal are these questions for you? Is it emotional for you to see the language being spoken less and less as people age and our culture changes?
Well, it's emotional with respect to the relationship to the speakers, yes. I mean, I've made countless, I'll say, friends or people that I've come to know, and many of them have now passed away. I work with a lot of times with people in their 80s. But, for instance, in Perry County, Missouri, near Cape Girardeau, there's still a pocket of folks that immigrated in the 1830s, their ancestors came in the 1830s, that still speak the Saxon dialect of, I'll say, Martin Luther, okay, and started the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church back in the 1840s.
And they speak the way Martin Luther, who started Lutheranism?
I'll go out on a limb and say yes.
Wow. Can you give an example of something that is spoken in that dialect that would have kind of vanished from the rest of German?
Mm-hmm. For instance, their word for chimney, in standard German, it would be something like Schornstein or Kamin, but they say Esse. Only exists in that part of the world. Another word for squirrel attracted my attention. They say it's an oak rabbit, Eichhase, which I seldom have encountered anywhere except in Missouri, maybe in Iowa.
Can you give one more example of it? I'm just loving these. Like a community that has preserved a word or a like time period of German.
How about Stinkkatze? That's a skunk.
That sounds exactly like what it is.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. Have a nice recording of a fellow shooting a skunk with his rifle and then throwing it over a bush.
You may notice that I have not given the phone number, and yet, despite that, we are suddenly, as the show is coming to an end, we have a full switchboard. And I'm not going to – we don't have time for the calls, but I do want to bring that up with you. You give talks all over the place. It seems like this is touching a nerve with a good handful of our listeners. When you go and give talks, what's bringing people and what is it that they are wanting to know from you?
Well, ultimately, I think we want to know, who am I? What are my origins? Where do I come from? Where were my ancestors come from? I mean, good grief, you see that on television. What's that? DNA and me, that kind of thing. People want to know, who am I?
You were about to say it in German.
Yeah, wer bin ich? Who am I? That's ultimately what we are trying to find out.
Well, our time is up. William Kiel, with us from KU's Department of German Studies, thank you so much for sharing your research.
Dankeschön.
William Kiel has been studying German as it's been spoken not in Germany, but in Kansas and Missouri in the last centuries. And that's a wrap. You can grab our conversations with Professor Keel and with the popular children's author Mo Willems at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard. Mo Willems has an exhibit up now in Topeka. Tomorrow, we will talk about steak. Someone from McGonagall's will explain the different cuts of steak that you see on menus. So why a filet mignon and a Kansas City strip are different. Not everyone knows, okay? Plus, tips and tricks for preparing steak at home, and you're going to need to call in and tell us where you get your favorite steak. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.